1994,
believed that we came from outer space, that we are the direct descendants of the intelligent people who landed here a long time ago.
Gene Phillips is the founder and president of the Ancient Astronaut Society. He claims that museums are hiding thousands of artifacts that do not conform to their narrow view of anthropology.
This is an exact replica of an object that is in the Smithsonian Museum, and they call it a stylized insect. The Smithsonian had it on display, and they used to sell replicas in their shop.
Phillips claims that after the Ancient Astronaut Society interpreted the object as a prehistoric space shuttle, the Smithsonian removed the original from public display. Phillips and his group have studied more than 150 ancient sites in 30 countries. These 5,000-year-old masks were unearthed in Eastern Europe. They bear a striking resemblance to modern-day depictions of supposed aliens known as greys.
There's a site in Bolivia, South America, called El Fuerte. What it looks like is a catapult-type launch site for space vehicles.
The Ancient Astronaut Society is not the only group supporting the theory of interplanetary contact. Author Zachariah Sitchin concurs in his book, The Twelfth Planet.
There is one more planet in our own solar system, not light years away, that comes near Earth between Mars and Jupiter every 3,600 years, at which time people, intelligent people, beings like us, come and go between their planet and our planet and brought us, Homo sapiens, about sooner than we might have appeared otherwise. Don't call them aliens, because we look like them, they look like us.
See, all we ask is that people have an open mind. Look at something with an open mind with today's space age eyes.
Scientists on the fringe of modern anthropology believe that their theories are not taken seriously because mainstream scientists are afraid to admit that they've been wrong.
All the textbooks would have to be rewritten. All the exhibits in the museums would have to be changed. This would be very embarrassing. And people who have positions to defend like that don't like to be embarrassed.
The idea of alien evolution does sound far-fetched, and its proponents are well aware of the fact that they're looked at as eccentric outsiders. They may not have all the answers, but it's often the so-called eccentrics who ask the most interesting questions.
Next.
Brought closure to many unsolved murder cases. And now, because of our original broadcast, another family can put a long-lost loved one to rest.
In 1980, police made a grisly discovery in a row house on North Lithgow Street in Philadelphia. The body they found was badly decomposed and bore no resemblance to the young woman she once was. That's where forensic sculptor Frank Bender comes in. He has an uncanny gift for creating a face on a bare skull, for giving life, if only in clay, to the victims of unsolved crimes. His studio is the final resting place for men, women, and children who have no names. Bender's technique combines forensic science with an emotional, some call it psychic, attachment. And it works. On a previous sightings, we profiled Bender and his amazing success rate.
After the first segment of sightings aired, I received numerous phone calls from people all around the country, basically saying that they were thanking sightings and also thanking me and the team involved for the work that we're doing.
And now, the woman who Frank Bender resurrected from a skull found on North Lithgow Street has a name. The wondering and waiting are over for one Philadelphia family. After 15 years, they know what happened to Jackie.
All these years, I never moved because I thought maybe she would come home. Never changed my phone number. Everything's been the same. Just in case she would reach out, as they say, and phone home.
Because of our broadcast, Frank Bender met police officer Virginia Hill, who works in the missing persons unit of the Philadelphia Police Department. Officer Hill inherited the Jackie Goff case 3 years ago.
The search for Jacqueline Goff started with me in 1991.
her skull.
The first time Officer Hill visited Frank Bender's studio, she was struck by the resemblance between Jackie Goff and one of the busts Bender had sculpted.
I came over to his studio, and we talked about it on a show that he was doing. And we put two and two together, and we both believed the same, that it was Jacqueline.
Forensic evidence supported the matchup. Jackie's dental records indicated she had an extra tooth. So did the skull that Bender had worked from. A photo of the bust was given to the Goff family. They made positive ID.
And from here up, I would almost have to say positively that it was. Frank has never met Jackie, but when he made this, it seemed like he knew her when he made it, because that looks like her through her eyes, top part of her face.
DNA results are still pending, but Frank Bender is confident he has made another match.
The payoff emotionally is satisfaction, the satisfaction of helping to put somebody's cases to rest.
Officer Hill is continuing to work with Frank Bender on other missing persons cases. The future is promising.
I work with families that are in great distress. A lot of families haven't heard from their children in 10, 15, even 20 years. And I get a lot of relief when a family has put it to rest, when we can positively identify someone and then they can go on with their lives.
Sadly, the bust that Frank Bender was sculpting during our original broadcast has still not been identified. Here, again, is the face of an unnamed child found murdered in Philadelphia in 1994. If you have any information about the identity of this little boy, believed to be 5 years old at the time of his death, please contact the Homicide Division of the Philadelphia Police Department.
Coming up, you can hear people screaming.
Are dangerous spirits haunting this historic site?
It was like walking into a ghost party.
Then, a child's tragic premonition. And this computer document may prove that we are not alone.
29. The gold rush is on. More than 85,000 people flock to California in search of the mother lode. A few become millionaires, but most barely scratch out a living. And many of the legendary 49ers die laboring with hand tools inside unstable mines. It is the ghosts of those who died trying that many believe are still here today, haunting a small town in the Sierra foothills of California.
You can hear explosions. You can hear fire crackling. You can hear people screaming.
In California's gold country, the mines are idle now. The streams and creeks played out. But in Jamestown, the spirit of the 49ers is still alive inside this hotel. You can still find a hot meal and friendly conversation at the Willow Hotel. And some people believe you can still hear strange echoes from the past.
I went into the bathroom, went to turn the light on, and something touched me on the back of my hand. I've seen spices fly off the shelves. Laughter in the kitchen when no one's there.
Ceiling fans coming on by themselves. Lights in here constantly going on and off.
Why does the Willow Hotel seem to be the focus of so much haunting activity? Many people believe it's because of a great mine disaster that killed 23 miners here in 1862. Before the dust had settled, construction began in the Willow Hotel. It was built directly on top of the mine where so many had lost their lives. Jamestown tried to put the past behind it. The hotel thrived, hosting presidents and gunslingers. But the past did not go away.
There's a lot of good here, but there's a lot of evil also.
The Willow Saloon has been in constant operation since 1862, but for the past 10 years, no one has slept here. A series of mysterious fires have engulfed the sleeping quarters three separate times, and always on the same date in years ending in 5. July 21st, 1955, July 21st, 1975. When the hotel burned on July 21st, 1985, no one wanted to rebuild.
We smelled smoke all day. And then later that evening, we spotted flames in the wainscoting over in the dining room. When the fire department came, they chopped the wall up and went through it and everything. Inside the wall, there was no electrical. There was nothing there to make that fire start. It just had started, like, from nothing.
Then after we got the fire put out, then Kevin, the owner, asked us to stick around just in case it reignited. And at that time, you start hearing two scratches from underneath the bar floor by the waitress station. I took a fast exit out the door, and then shortly after that, out of this wall that I'm leaning against came like two massive exhales.
Word spread about the strange fires at the Willow. A local news crew came in to conduct an overnight surveillance.
We set the camera back on the tripod, and we left it just sitting there. Nobody touched it, and the camera went to black and white, and we had, electrical was blinking in and out, and the walls of the booth in the front there started rolling as if, an earthquake, was making the walls roll out. We did play it back.
Yeah, we had lines going across it, and then it started rolling, and then ever since then, I haven't been able to really view it.
It kept shutting the VCR off, ejecting the tape, and it was a brand new tape.
That same television crew took these photographs and claimed they saw transparent entities hiding in the shadows.
I just looked across the room and I just saw somebody standing at the booth. And as soon as I got up, he just disappeared. He was gone. That was the reason why I took a picture of the booth to see what would happen. And then it appears that there are two faces in the booth, one on each side. And one of the faces looks like he has a miner's hat.
Are these entities somehow responsible for the fires? Do they have a connection to the Great Jamestown Fire of 1896 that destroyed almost everything but the Willow?
In the late 1800s, when the town was burning and they dynamited some of the other buildings to save this one, they said while they were dynamiting, a man was killed, and they said one of the kinfolk from the man that was killed is who keeps lighting this place on fire.
Or is the haunting here related to the turbulent times the Willow experienced during Prohibition?
In 1925, Gus Ratto, who was leasing the bar at the time, went upstairs to his wife's room and called to her, and when she opened the door, he fired one shot into her head and turned around and shot another into his own head.
Since 1972, the place has belonged to the Mooney family. When Kevin Mooney took over 4 years ago, he was a confirmed skeptic. Until he had his own sighting.
I'm getting ready to walk through the back door when I look up at the window and there's eyes two red eyes looking through the window. My heart started going, oh God. I get outside, my heart's boom, boom, boom. I look around, there's nothing there.
The Moonies had earlier contacted parapsychologists Nick Nocerino and Chuck Pelton to conduct a thorough investigation.
Yeah, something here is very hot. Very hot. This is where the apparition should be. If there's going to be an apparition, it should be in this area.
When you walk through this building, you still feel heat, you feel fire, you smell smoke.
Pelton and Nocerino believe that there are three layers of hauntings here, caused by what they have termed residual thought forms.
Well, thought form is probably an event that took place that these people are reliving. And if you tie that into a quick death, had it been from a fire explosion, a mine cave-in, it's even possible these people don't know that they're dead.
No one can predict if the haunting forms of the past will appear again. But you can bet everyone in Jamestown will be keeping an eye on the Willow every July 21st, ending in 5.
The pattern of fires occurring on the same date nearly every decade since 1955 has all the earmarks of a classic arson pattern. That's what the Tuolumne County Fire Department originally thought. But their extensive investigation has ruled out arson as a possible cause.
When sightings continues, a child's premonition turns tragedy into hope.
Katie was given a glimpse from the other side.
Researchers believe that we are born with extraordinary powers of ESP, but as we grow older, our psychic ability is weakened by a world that teaches us to rely on empirical thinking. If this is true, it might help explain why young Katie Thronson had a premonition of death that tragically came true.
This is the last picture Katie Thronson ever drew. It was her vision of another life beyond this one. It seemed to spring from an active imagination. But less than a week after Katie showed the drawing to her mother, the little girl, who seemed heaven sent, was gone.
Katie was a beautiful little girl who was really happy and was always kissing people. Just really loved.
She'd always have her arms around other children. She seemed to be the one that always brought children together.
Over the course of almost 7 years, she had hundreds of drawings. She expressed herself by drawing hearts all the time because she was filled with love.
Julie Thronson vividly recalls one day in October of 1991 when Katie came to her out of the blue with an unsettling question.
She came into the room where I was sitting, holding a tablet that she had been drawing on, and in a real innocent way came up to me and asked me, "Mommy, am I going to die?" And I said, "No, honey, of course not. You're not going to die." And she said, "Never." And I said, "Katie, no, you're not going to die." Then she just danced off, happy that she wasn't going to die.
But 2 days later, Katie developed what appeared to be a severe flu. The next day, her condition worsened, and she was rushed to the hospital. Doctors suspected that Katie had a ruptured appendix.
In the hours after that time, and prior to her going to surgery, her prognosis had become extremely grave.
Julie never left her daughter's side. Just before 3 o'clock, while Katie was awaiting surgery, there was a change in her breathing. She lapsed into unconsciousness, and Julie could not wake her.
I said, Katie, just talk to Mama. And she wasn't responding to me at all. And I looked at the clock, and it was right at 3 o'clock. I looked at the clock, I looked at her, and suddenly she just sat up in the hospital bed, raised her arms out towards the window, opened her eyes. It was like she wanted me to pick her up, yet she wasn't in my direction. There was this stillness in the room that is indescribable. It was just completely still. It was like an infinite moment. And in my spirit, I just knew that my little girl had been taken. And I ran out into the hall, and I just yelled. My little girl just died. I just saw her die.
A medical team rushed in to try to revive Katie. Julie waited in the hallway, just outside the room where her daughter was dying.
And then I noticed a pregnant woman walking towards me. And I could tell by the look in her eyes that she was going to say something to me. And she came right up to me. She touched me on the shoulder. And she said, "The Lord has spoken to me. You're to be like a lioness. Your little girl is okay." And I just felt this shiver go through my body. And I thought, if the Lord has spoken to her, then Katie is okay. Whether she's gonna live or whether she's gone to God, Katie's gonna be okay.
The woman disappeared as if into thin air, and Julie never saw her again. Katie was being kept alive with machines. After 3 days, doctors pronounced her legally brain dead. The Thronsons made the agonizing decision to remove life support.
The autopsy indicated that there was indeed appendicitis and that there had been extension of this infection locally to other organs that were nearby.
Officially, Katie died October 10th, but both Julie and her doctor believe Katie was gone much sooner.
When I told the doctor that at that time she had raised her arms out towards the window, he said, "I believe that that was the time that Katie left her body." And that although they artificially kept her alive, she had died at 3 o'clock.
It was 6-year-old Katie who was the first to be laid to rest in the family plot. It was an unspeakable tragedy from which the Thronsons never thought they would recover. But a few months later, there was a ray of hope stuffed inside a cardboard box. Julie found the tablet that Katie had been drawing on just days before her death.
She had drawn a picture of these angels surrounding a light, and the cloud and the moon had sad faces, and all the angels had sad faces, and some of them even had tears coming down their face. The picture said everything. When I saw it, I knew without a doubt that Katie had a premonition.
Julie drew strength from that cherished drawing. Then, 5 months after Katie's death, a picture appeared in Life magazine that seemed to confirm Julie's belief that her daughter's drawing was a premonition. This 19th century engraving was part of an article about life after death. The depiction of a welcoming vortex of light was strikingly similar to Katie's own vision. Both pictures have a circular pattern that resembles the tunnel of light commonly reported in near-death experiences. Coincidence? Or did Katie receive a divine message?
She knew she was going to die. She drew that picture. She asked me, "Mommy, am I going to die?"
Whether or not she knew the meaning of it, I believe her spirit did.
Author Dr. Gerald Jampolsky is a child psychiatrist who counsels bereaved families. After Julie Thronson saw the Life magazine article, she wrote to Dr. Jampolsky and asked him to look at Katie's drawing.
I pointed out that at 3 o'clock, it looked like one of the angels was going toward the center, going toward the light.
I was like amazed for a minute, and he continued it, but I'm thinking, he doesn't know that Katie died at 3 o'clock. There's no way he can know that.
Julie also tried to find the pregnant woman who had comforted her. The hospital gave her the names and phone numbers of all the women in the maternity ward that day, but none of them remembered speaking to Julie.
She was obviously an angel. There was some kind of a message there of life and death and birth.
The cycle of death and birth continues. There is a new life in the Thronson family. Little Cody was born on October 7th, 1992, 1 year to the day after Katie died. It was an uncanny coincidence.
I was once told a definition of coincidence that I've always found very helpful. A coincidence is a miracle in which God wishes to remain anonymous. That makes a lot of sense to me.
When the Thronsons take Katie's brothers and sisters to her grave, the family remembers and talks about what they believe is God's plan.
It was a gift from beyond, maybe a gift from God.
The impact that drawing has had on our life is just beyond words. We have this to share with people. We have the hope to share with people that there is a beautiful side to all of this.
It helped us in the healing because it gave us both peace. I felt honored that Katie was given a glimpse from the other side.
There's just the fact that there's life after death. And even though we can't see it, it exists.
Just a few weeks ago, the Thronsons were in a serious car accident. Fortunately, everyone's all right. They're recovering at home. But something strange happened during that crash. 3-year-old Christopher told his mother and father that right after the moment of impact, he saw Katie.
Up next.
It was 5 to 6 times stronger than any signal in the past.
After receiving what could be an extraterrestrial message, this facility could be shut down.
In the universe, are there other intelligent beings somewhere that we might perhaps converse with at some point, or at least learn of the existence of?
The universe has no beginning, no middle, and no end. In such a limitless ocean of planets, moons, and stars, are we really the only life form searching outer space? Is another civilization trying to make contact? Astronomers operating this telescope believe contact has been made.
It was exactly the kind of signal that we are looking for. It's a narrowband signal, clearly of intelligent origin, clearly not interference, not any of those things.
In the late 1950s, Ohio State University began construction on what would become the world's largest radio telescope. It was designed to pick up and record the noises of space. And for over 15 years, it cataloged a symphony of static pops and hisses that were emanating naturally from satellites, stars, and explainable sources. Then, in the mid-1970s, the radio telescope known as the Big Ear received NASA sponsorship and began listening for evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence. In 1977, they got their first hit.
I had the task to look at the computer printouts to see if there was anything interesting. Anything four or above was definitely unusual. Well, this was the equivalent of 30. And so it was so strong, 5 to 6 times stronger than I had seen any signal in the past, that I was astonished and immediately wrote the word wow exclamation point in the margin of the computer printout.
The very strange thing is we have these two beams in the sky. We saw it in only one of those beams. So that means that it turned off or on, one or the other, as we were watching it, which is even further indication of intelligent origin. The tantalizing thing is we went back and looked hundreds of times later and it was never there again. So we will never know exactly what that was. It could have been from some other civilization.
The spontaneous signal became known as the Big Wow. It immediately sparked serious debate among astronomers. No one could explain the origin of the signal, but many scientists would not accept it as proof of intergalactic communication. Others insisted the Big Wow was Earth's first contact with an extraterrestrial intelligence. The debate continues to this day.
The fundamental problem in a scientific experiment is if you can't repeat it, you can't say it exists.
Dr. Lewis Friedman does not believe that the Big Wow is definitive proof of interstellar communication. But he does believe it is an important piece of a larger puzzle that the Big Ear will someday solve.
Nonetheless, it has, over the time, made very useful observations in the whole search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
But despite the Big Ear's scientific contributions, the radio telescope's future is on shaky ground.
Congress did cut out the funding last year, and that has made the SETI program really disappear from all government activities. Because the subject deals with extraterrestrial life, it's a subject that is obviously capable of ridicule. And Congress didn't continue the funding because they were susceptible to those kinds of jokes.
Unfortunately, the land the Big Ear sits on is becoming more valuable than the radio telescope itself. Without federal funding, it's up to private organizations like the Planetary Society to stave off destruction of the project.
The idea that someone out there may be transmitting and we're not listening is not one that we in the Planetary Society are comfortable with.
Currently, everyone who works on the project works for free. The Big Ear is supported by volunteers who don't want to see the project die.
We have people from all walks of life. I mean, we have an attorney, we have physicists, astronomers, a chemist, school teachers, a jukebox repairman, people who just do anything that you can imagine, volunteer here.
The Planetary Society encourages anyone with an interest in the heavens to join them. Volunteers who aren't physicists or astronomers learn from those who are.
If it weren't for someone like me coming up and moving, repointing the telescope a couple times a week, then no such survey would be done.
Their equipment is sadly outdated, but the Big Ear volunteers are undaunted. Who knows when one of them will be able to write, wow, on a computer printout.
There's no telling what extraterrestrial civilization's power is, so even the weakest equipment might be able to pick something up.
Eventually they will transmit, but I think we'll hear it. If not in my lifetime, then the next one. It seems unlikely that only here, in this very typical place, that life would have formed. In fact, if we go on searching for a long period of time and never find anything, that will be an even stranger situation. But we will have to then understand why did life form only here and nowhere else.
We want the Earth to be listening. We have a lot to learn in this area. Who knows where we'll strike a little gold in those hills.
The land underneath the Big Ear is leased to Ohio State by a land development corporation. The university's 10-year lease expires next year. And there are rumors that when it does, one of the world's tallest radio telescopes.
Do all your holiday shopping at Floyd's.
A bunch of lunatics running around saying that they saw lights in the sky.